energy is being used as a weapon against many parts of the world now. That has a cascade effect. And then if you look at what's happening with the oil industry and the reduction in production of the oil that we need, that's also causing another issue. And if we really look at it, we are in a short supply on energy across the globe.
Carbon capture is one of the many, many things we need to do. We need to turn CO2 into stuff. Look around right now. Anything that is not metal or glass is made of carbon. And in fact, we have carbon-based products that could substitute for metal or glass. So we're getting to a point where the built world can be made out of materials made out of carbon, and that carbon can be sourced from things other than fossil fuels. The technology has come a long way. We now have party dresses made by Zara that are made out of CO2. My favorite vodka in the world by Air Company is super delicious and is made out of CO2 pulled from the air. There's companies that are selling diamonds made out of CO2. So you can, in fact, do this.
This is Radical Reinvention, a show from Zero 100 about reimagining global supply chains. I'm Deborah Dull. Inventory is my favorite topic, and I've spent my career trying to figure out how supply chains can save the world. But I've learned most of the time supply chains aren't designed around the needs of the planet or its people. So our mission at Zero 100 is certainly ambitious. Our goal is to create a 0% carbon and 100% digital global supply chain. We believe it's possible, but we know we can't do it alone. That's why we're building a community of the world's most innovative supply chain pioneers, industry experts, and scientists, and working together to tackle some of the biggest challenges facing the planet today. We're inviting all of you along for the ride. Join us as we work to create a sustainable and responsible supply chain, one radical reinvention at a time. For today's episode, we're going to try to demystify the relationship between energy and carbon, specifically between energy and carbon in supply chains. Now, before we go further, let's talk about why this matters. Well, supply chains are a major source of carbon emissions, right? But the real story, I think, is in investigating where in operations the emissions are coming from. And that's where things get complicated. It's partly because most energy sources are very carbon dioxide intensive, and it turns out the ones we thought were solutions may actually pose new problems. The world is also facing a growing energy crisis, partly because of ongoing and devastating global conflicts like the Russia-Ukraine war, but more fundamentally because modern human lifestyles just demand more energy consumption than ever before. Combined with the reality that energy is the great source of carbon emissions on the planet, we're at a pretty serious crossroads when it comes to this issue. And supply chains are in a perfect position to do something about this right now. In this episode, we're going to explore why it's so hard for most of us to wrap our brains around this relationship between energy and carbon.
People may not understand energy is because there's no need to. Frankly, the modern world has made access to energy so affordable, reliable, and out of sight that no one really sees or understands where the primary energy comes from.
Most people actually have no idea how much energy they use. It is invisible. It enters their lives. They pay for it. They don't really even know the price of it. If you ask most people like what their electricity price is, they don't know. They just pay the bill.
We'll hear a few case studies of how some companies are working to decarbonize energy right now.
A lot of our business is baking, and we've made a commitment to move out of the old gas burner ovens, meant to go back to look at electric ovens, and how do we get our bakeries to become electric, clean energy? Certainly in my team, everybody's working frantically to find opportunities to do things differently, but it takes time to do that on energy. And if you're not set up to be able to take different sources of energy, it becomes harder.
And brainstorm a very cool way to digitize operations on the road to carbon-free energy.
When it comes to digital and supply chains, digital threads can provide the opportunity for collaboration between different partners, whether that's your suppliers and even down to your customers. I think that is a huge opportunity that any company with a supply chain can really take and run with.
Our guests today are Sandra McQuillan, the Chief Supply Chain Officer at Mondelez International, a global packaged snacks brand, Dr. Julio Friedman, the chief scientist at Carbon Direct, an end-to-end carbon action platform, and Nalin Agarwal, the co-founder of The Climate Collective, a climate tech startup accelerator based in India. Finally, we'll be joined by Shelby Newsom, a research manager here at Zero 100, who will talk to us about the power of digital threads to reduce carbon in supply chains. Let's jump in. So, what exactly do we mean when we talk about energy? And what does that have to do with carbon? We're all familiar with energy and carbon, of course, as concepts in our daily lives and on the daily news, whether we're supply chain professionals or just regular human beings living in the 21st century. For many of us, though, it can be pretty difficult to wrap our heads around what it actually means.
So when people say there's a carbon neutral building, I'm like, well, how exactly is that working? Or when people say we want carbon neutral supply chains, it's like, okay, so all the ships, all the trucks are on zero carbon fuels? Or they're all electric, powered by zero carbon electricity? If you are buying anything, basically, except for wood, maybe, anything that you're buying has embedded carbon emissions in it. When you're like, I have a zero carbon car, it's like, no, you don't. The steel has carbon emissions and energy. The plastic has carbon emissions and energy. And the fuel has carbon emissions and energy. Generally speaking, fuels are where most of the carbon is these days. It's part of the reason we need zero carbon fuels. So there is carbon emissions and energy use in refining, in shipping oil around the world, but 95% of the carbon is in the fuel itself.
That's Dr. Julio Friedman, who, as I mentioned earlier, is the chief scientist at Carbon Direct. He's also a fellow at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University, and he used to be the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Office of Fossil Energy at the U.S. Energy Department. In other words, he knows a lot about the relationship between energy and carbon. According to Dr. Friedman, there's a good reason why most people don't realize just how much energy they use.
Most people don't know the difference between a kilowatt and a megawatt or why it matters. And since it's not in our day-to-day, because it's an abstract, invisible concept, because it is hard to measure in the way that we human beings constantly see, it is in fact an abstract concept and process.
And Dr. Friedman says it's also really hard for most people to understand just how much carbon is emitted by that energy.
Greenhouse gas emissions accumulate in the atmosphere for a very, very, very long time. That's what drives man-made global warming. Out of that, about 75% of every molecule that goes into the atmosphere comes from combustion of fossil fuels. Something, again, which most people don't understand is that energy and carbon emissions is in everything. A good example of this is concrete. Concrete is the second most used substance in the world after water. We use 30 billion tons of it a year. It uses a huge amount of energy because the recipe for concrete is you heat a rock to 1400 degrees Celsius, and that turns it into cement. And then you ship it all over the place, and then you mix it with water, and you drive it in trucks, and you mix it with rocks, and then you pour it out. And like every step of that uses a lot of energy and has emissions. And the total emissions from concrete is more than the total emission of cars. All the cars in the world emit less than all the concrete in the world.
Okay, so it's clear that we live in a high energy consumption, high carbon output world. That's why Nalin Agarwal co-founded the Climate Collective, a nonprofit based in India, that's, quote, focused on empowering entrepreneurs throughout the global south by building or strengthening local climate startup ecosystems by bridging the gap between the development and private sectors. Nalin agrees that much of the world is in a position where they don't need to think much about their energy consumption as long as they can access it and afford it. But in other parts of the world, energy access, especially clean energy access and affordability, aren't a given.
Today, about 13% of the world, which is about a billion people, mostly in Africa and a few in Asia, don't have access to reliable energy. And what we need to do is to provide them the same level of energy delivery that the majority of the world gets, which is energy that's affordable, that's abundant, that's reliable, and that's clean. The pace of change in the last 10, 15 years has been commendable. So for example, India has gone from 50% access in 1990, which is just 32 years ago, to about 99% in 2020. So in 30 years, we've gone from 50 to almost 100%. Indonesia has gone from 62% to 98% in 2020. Combined effort, maybe 20% of the world has gone to relatively better levels of energy access.
Okay, so this is a big conversation, and it can feel pretty overwhelming when you start thinking about all of the variables and places and problems involved. But this is a supply chain podcast, right? So let's focus on that. Where does supply chain fit into this conversation? Here's Sandra McQuillan, the Chief Supply Chain Officer at Mondelez International, the major snack food empire behind favorites like Toblerone and Oreo and Wheat Thins. She's also on the board here at Zero 100.
We measure CO2. We measure waste in terms of what comes out of factories, which you can hark back to how we measure our own body's efficiency in terms of what it does. It's exactly the same thinking. Let's measure how much we waste. Let's measure how much we use. Let's measure how much energy we've got. But we use carbon as the base for that. So most of our energy sources are from carbon, which emits things like CO2 into the air. And so part of the responsibility we have then is to remove as much of that as we can. And we're all setting ourselves challenges to get to zero carbon emissions by 2050, I think it is the global piece, actually. And then internally, we're setting things up to go bit by bit towards that in 2030 and beyond.
Sandra believes that it's up to supply chain professionals to recognize and do something about the volume of emissions coming out of operations. That's why she's focused Mondelez's efforts on decarbonizing their factory emissions by finding ways to use low carbon and renewable energy sources in production.
We've set ourselves goals for 2025, 2030, 2050. It's very carbon focused, very fossil fuel focused. So that then prompts us to go into a whole area of looking at, well, how can we have renewable processes? So how can we use wind? How can we use solar? What can we do to minimize the use of water?
Reducing water, by the way, is absolutely critical here because delivering water for industrial and domestic use has the single biggest embedded energy cost of all commodities. This is a topic I'm a little bit obsessed with as a supply chain professional, but maybe we'll get into that in another episode. For now, back to Sandra.
We try and run our factories on closed loops with that. And waste is a huge one because not only do you generate it through inefficiency, but then you have to get rid of it. And you know, you don't want to send it to landfill if you can help it because that then just decays and you have to deal with that at some point. You don't really want to burn it because that's basically doing exactly the same as emitting into the air. Going back to electricity, we're a bakery in essence. A lot of our business is baking. And we've made a commitment to move out of the old gas burner ovens to go back to electric ovens. And how do we get our bakeries to become electric, clean energy, which can come from different sources rather than coal for that? It's more expensive to run, but if it's more expensive and it's cleaner, then that's where we need to go. So that would be a specific example. Obviously, we use solar power as much as we can, particularly in the eastern part of the world and in the southern part of the world. We have a lot of solar farms there, and we have Latin America actually in our organization that's full on 100% renewable energy. So you can actually do it, which is fantastic, but you need to be resilient and resourceful in how you go about making it happen. And then the third one, we do a lot of parity purchasing agreements, which is for wind power. And we'll work with wind farms to be able to invest with them to then get the source of wind energy, which then means the whole cycle works well and we're not stripping the world of its fossil fuels.
Dr. Friedman says another company making real headway in this effort is Microsoft.
I like talking about Microsoft because they've been very transparent about this. Microsoft has a pretty low carbon footprint for a company their size. They have a $2 trillion valuation. Their carbon footprint is 16 million tons, scope 1, 2, and 3. Excellent. 95% of those emissions are scope 3, which means it's their supply chains. They have a very aggressive reduction program. They're going to go from 16 million tons down to 10 in the next 8 years. That means they have a residual emission of 6. One third of their emissions, they have no solution for at all. And this is a software company. So they have to start buying carbon removals. And they've moved into the carbon removal space as sort of a thing that they know they have to do. And if they want to hit that target in 2030, they have to be super proactive on it. And they're doing exactly that.
The real power of this movement, according to Dr. Friedman, is in the merging of forces among manufacturing, science, and technology.
Carbon capture is one of the many, many things we need to do. We need to do efficiency, we need to do renewables, we need to do electrification. We also need to do carbon capture, and we need to turn CO2 into stuff. I'm going to ask your listeners to look around them right now. Anything that is not metal or glass is made of carbon. We have carbon-based products that could substitute for metal or glass. So we're getting to a point where the built world can be made out of materials made out of carbon, and that carbon can be sourced from things other than fossil fuels. We can pull it from biomass, we can pull it from the air and oceans, and that's starting to look interesting. The technology has come a long way. We now have party dresses made by Zara that are made out of CO2. My favorite vodka in the world by Air Company is super delicious and is made out of CO2 pulled from the air. There's companies that are selling diamonds made out of CO2 pulled from the air. So you can, in fact, do this. It is pricey. It is also the case that you can make fuels out of CO2 from the air. The second law of thermodynamics is pretty harsh about this. You will put more energy into that fuel than you got out of it in the first place. We are still working on that, and it's tricky, but the technology is moving along quite well.
But if it's pricey, how feasible is it really? Is it possible to afford to actually make this work?
It turns out that to the end customer, the cost is not that big. So let's say that you replaced all of the full components of a car with low carbon sourced steel, plastics made out of CO2 from the air. It would maybe raise the price of a car 4%. For a sneaker sold by Adidas or Nike, like 2% of the cost is making the sneaker. So if you doubled that price, it'd be like 4% of the cost. Most of the cost of a sneaker is other stuff. It's not the cost of the raw materials. But to the manufacturer in the supply chain, if you're making low carbon steel, that doubles the cost of steel. At which point they're like, we're out of the market. If we doubled our price, we'd have no customers, right? So we are grappling with how it is we put these supply chains together, and carbon capture is part of that. So you can do the carbon capture on a truck and then try to sell that CO2 into something that, say, makes concrete or something that makes fuels or plastic, right? You can do that. Those markets are immature. It'll take a while before you can sell that CO2 to somebody. You can take that CO2 from the air using a direct air capture device. You could put that CO2 into, say, a party dress. Right now, we don't have the supply chains to make that. Zara is already sold out. All those party dresses are bought, so they actually don't have enough manufacturing capacity. There's finally a challenge with tonnage. So most people, again, don't think about this stuff because they don't go to the store and buy a gigaton of methanol. Like, they just don't do these things. For that matter, they don't buy a gigaton of carrots. Like, they just don't know what a gigaton is. A gigaton is twice the weight of all the people on Earth. It's a big number. All of the plastic market in the world is 1 gigaton. That's it. So maybe you can put 100 million tons of CO2 into it, but you can't put 5 billion tons of CO2 into that market. It's just not big enough. Like, even the concrete market, which is big, maybe you can get a couple of gigatons of CO2 into that market, but that's not enough for greenhouse gas emissions. That's like 51 billion tons a year. So carbon capture is going to be necessary to store and permanently dispose of a bunch of CO2. And for things like cement or steel or chemicals or fertilizer or plastic, that's the thing you can do today that is fast and cheap. And because these are really narrow commodity margins, like, there's not a lot of money floating around the steel market to sort of make this happen, that's where government incentives become really important. And the Inflation Reduction Act has all kinds of goodies in it for low carbon hydrogen, for carbon capture, for building factory floors in clean ways. And those incentive packages are to help decarbonize today's supply chain, not tomorrow's supply chain.
This aggressive approach to using technology for decarbonization is exactly what Nalin and the folks at Climate Collective hopes to inspire more of through their mission.
We run some of the largest climate tech accelerators in South Asia. We have a bunch of capital initiatives. If you imagine us as ecosystem builders, and the ecosystem having the supply side, which is the climate startups, you have the capital side that supports the growth of these startups, and then you have the demand side, which is largely industrial demand and supply chain decarbonization, etc. So if you imagine these three are the key pillars, we do work across all of this. So as I mentioned, we run accelerators and entrepreneurship development programs for startups. We have capital programs, we have an equity crowdfunding platform, we have an angel network, and we have an emerging seed stage pre-series A fund on the capital side. And then we have an industry decarbonization platform to spur demand from industry. Few other things that we do, of course, we're getting stronger at research in climate tech, et cetera, but conceptually, you can think of us as an ecosystem builder for the climate tech startup ecosystem.
Now that we know a bit about the ways some companies and communities are working to decarbonize energy and supply chains, the next question is, what about the companies that haven't started doing this yet? How and where should they start? Since Climate Collective have worked with so many different companies, and Mondelez has done so much to move the needle here, I was curious about what Nalin's and Sandra's guidance would be.
Waste is a huge opportunity. We all try and get to the 1% waste of our systems. If you're at 5%, which some places are, then even halving that will give you a benefit in terms of using your energy, because you won't be using it to get rid of the waste. You'll be using it to actually run your equipment. If you can get the efficiency and effectiveness of your sites running much better, then you can use less energy to make them run. Get tighter and tighter and tighter about how much energy you use to make things. And that reduces your CO2, as well as reusing it, recycling, and actually removing it from the chain if you can. Take it out. If you don't really need the plastic, whatever, then take it out. Because sometimes we do things that we think the consumer really, really wants, and actually the consumer doesn't care. They just want to have something fresh and good quality. And it doesn't matter that it has three wrappers on it. Maybe it just only needs the one. And then you've already reduced your consumption and your energy usage and your CO2 emissions by doing that, because you don't need to worry about them. The other two layers are gone. So there's simple things like that. And then on water usage, you can do the same. Years ago, there was a big issue with water in Australia. They were on a drought almost all the time. But being ready for that, being ready by understanding the environment you're operating in and what you should be doing, because we should be reducing the use of water anyway and putting it in the right place for the people that need it. Quite simple things that you can do to start off with, and just understand where your base is. And then from your base, you can work on what should I do? And are there easy fixes, low-hanging fruit that I can do? And then what are the bigger things?
They need to start measuring and showing, okay, this is how we measure, this is what we found. If it's not perfect, it's fine. So let's assume we need to do better than where we are, even if we don't know if we are here or yet. Let's start with a ballpark estimate. This is where we are and this is where we need to be. Start with that. The last two things relate directly to supply chain, and specifically the suppliers in the value chain. And that's to support them, whether it's through knowledge, research, or whether it's through direct support. Maybe it's cost sharing. For example, some of the large marine or the shipping lines, they actually support some of their suppliers in partly financing the CapEx. So everyone needs to, for example, buy new equipment. So that has a CapEx implication. So there's some cost sharing there, right? And these large guys can actually finance this CapEx as well. So some of it potentially could be grant, some of it could be low-cost financing or all of those things. And the last thing is incentivize the suppliers. You know, so one is support them in this transition. And incentives can come in various ways. Of course, recognition is one. It's probably stronger than we think. The other is, of course, you could give them price premiums, etc., for providing you low-carbon goods. So yeah, I would just start from building consensus that action is needed. You can start measuring, but let's start taking action and then supporting the players in the value chain. And then us as a large organization being role models and advocates for everyone else in the ecosystem.
And because Sandra has been so focused on decarbonizing energy at Mondelez, I thought she might have some interesting insights on what success, or at least progress, looks like.
There are a lot now of external bodies that measure sustainability. It's quite complex, and you can end up committing to things that you don't even know that you've committed to because you've joined a certain group sort of thing. Yeah, but there's enough out there that you can get measured and you can see your move against your peer group as well as yourself year on year. Don't do it before you understand what's happening internally. And you're then looking internally at what do I use already, and are there systems I can use from a technology point of view? Then you start really making a shift in this and you measure yourself. So we have three very clear metrics in CO2 emissions, water usage, and waste. And we measure those every single day, every single week, and then we report them every month as our indicators of whether or not we are actually delivering on what we say we're going to deliver on sustainability. And we know the impact of a line that goes in on our CO2 emissions or on our energy usage. And we try always to go for a lower usage, lower energy rated, but still effective and efficient and brings good quality of products out. We try and go for those that meet the holistic needs of what supply chain should be doing. Can we find a more efficient route to travel so that people aren't having to use more mileage than they need to use? And can we go to less gas and petrol engines that maybe we can go electric on those as well? I'm on a board of directors for a company called Trimble, and they do a lot of work with autonomous vehicles, which means you get it right, then not only do you save on your costs of running it, but you save on your operational costs as well. Energy is being used as a weapon against many parts of the world now. That has a cascade effect. And then if you look at what's happening with the oil industry and the reduction in production of the oil that we need, that's also causing another issue. And if we really look at it, we are in a short supply on energy across the globe. For the last 3 years, it's actually been hell in supply chain, trying to make things work, get what you need, manufacture it quick enough, get people to lift it, to then ship it where it needs to go. I'm so proud of what the supply chain people did and have continued to do. It's absolutely incredible. So I look at that and I see if we can manage these last 3 years so well, even with the trauma and the exhaustion that it creates for us all, which it does, then I feel very optimistic looking at what we've done so far. And I feel very optimistic when I know the other CSCOs that sit around the table. But if you look at the critical mass that we've got in corporations around the world, if we chose for a few of us to get together, we could actually make even more significant impact as supply chain.
I also had to ask, and I was especially interested in Dr. Friedman's views here, since he's been such a realist on this issue, what, if anything, is he optimistic about in this effort?
There's a couple of things that keep me optimistic. One of them is we've made more progress than most people realize. Like 10 years ago, we were heading to like 5 degrees of warming or 4 degrees of warming. That would have been catastrophically bad. Now we're on track to like 2.5 or 3 degrees of warming, which is also terrible, but it's not as bad as that other one, right? And if you look at the commitments that were announced at Glasgow's Conference of the Parties, COP26, if every country makes those commitments, that's a big if, but if they did it, we'd be in a 1.7 degree world, which would still be bad, but again, way better. So we've made a lot of progress. We're in the post-dithering world. That's the first order of business. The second is we have all the tools. We have the technologies we need. We have the policy frameworks we largely need. We have markets that are coming forward. The public's aware. And it means that what we have to focus on now is actually compromise. We have to focus on cooperation and generosity. We have to listen better, but also be more ambitious and work faster. So we have to combine ambition with humility. That's not something people do very well. And we also have the money now. It's patchy. It's not everywhere. It's not a revenue stack that helps everybody, but we basically have the money now. So that's good. That keeps me optimistic. For every bag of coffee you roast, it emits 2 bags of CO2. But now we have the technology to capture that CO2, make it into plastic, print a mug on my 3D printer, and I can drink the coffee out of that mug. And none of that existed 5 years ago. We are innovating at an incredible, prodigious, awe-inspiring rate. This is the thing I tell everybody these days. It doesn't matter whether I am optimistic or pessimistic. The work is the same. So dust yourself off and get to work.
Like we say in the show opening, our mission is an ambitious one, but we really do believe it's possible. And we think coming together like we've done today and on our first couple of episodes is one way to get there. We're also big believers in the power of digitizing supply chains here at 0100. But what exactly does that mean? And how does it help us to decarbonize energy chains? To help us dig into some of the ways we can, as we like to say, digitize to decarbonize, I'm joined by 0100's research manager, Shelby Newsom. Welcome, Shelby.
Hey, Deborah.
So we've been talking a lot about energy, energy flows, what it means for supply chains. Let's get real. When we start thinking about energy or like anything flowing through our supply chains, how do you think digital plays a role in that?
I really think when it comes to digital and supply chains, the fact that digital can provide the opportunity for collaboration between different partners, whether that's your suppliers and even down to your customers, I think that is a huge opportunity that any company with a supply chain can really take and run with.
Amazing. What's one tool to use to do that?
I love digital threads.
I'm loving that you love digital threads. So spoiler alert, Shelby and I worked on a report together that's all about digital threads. So if there's two people who are super enthusiastic about that, it's us two. All right, Shelby. So everybody's heard of a digital twin at this point. We've talked about these for a long time. What then is a digital thread?
Absolutely. So a digital thread allows you to track the path of an object as it moves through an organization's value chain. So as it moves upstream or downstream, the thread provides real-time communication across multiple business units, including product design, manufacturing, service, and even with suppliers.
So it's like the ultimate traceability, look forward, look backwards, timing, all that kind of stuff. So digital threads, Shelby, help us make this real. So totally get that it allows us to track a thing, a material, maybe carbon, through an operation. Let's walk this through the functions we like to look at in this show. Source, make, move. Let's start with source. Give us an example of some supply chain that's doing this. How are they doing it?
Sure. So today we're specifically talking about carbon, and digital threads can track carbon too. So threads can follow carbon from raw materials extraction through assembly, transportation, use, recycling, and so on. So an example is with a Jaguar Land Rover. They wanted to assess their carbon footprint when it came to leather in their vehicles. They began working with supply chain traceability company Circular. With the use of blockchain technology, they were able to create a carbon tracking solution along with GPS, biometrics, and QR codes, and they were able to digitally verify movement of raw materials from farm to product. So with this digital thread, they now had a flow of material which informs the carbon verification.
Amazing. So like leather seats in the car, but now they know kind of like which cow it came from, the path it took to get there, and the carbon along the way.
Absolutely. And now they know what's going on with their luxury cars, and consumers are informed.
Oh, to be a luxury consumer. What a life. All right. So that's source. Obviously, a whole lot more that we can unpack there, but that should give folks a place to start. Let's continue through value chain land here. So we sourced something. We can check out the carbon footprint of that. Let's move on to make. Who's doing something cool in this space?
Adidas is. They are collaborating with their suppliers and Trust Trace, which is a fashion supply chain traceability company, to actually collect data in real time. So they're working together to create a digital thread by linking 10,000 different certified materials from design through the supply chain and down to the use.
Did you say 10,000?
10,000.
Wow. It's pretty cool. I think sometimes the average, very well-informed consumer often just doesn't realize how many materials and suppliers and moving parts come into a supply chain. And, you know, Adidas, so you don't think, wow, 10,000 materials. That's great. And the company Trust Trace, an interesting one there. Everybody check out the show notes. We'll include some links to all of these. All right, so let's bring it home. That source, that's make. What about move? Something moving through a network. This is often the sweetheart of a lot of traceability initiatives. How can a digital thread play a role here?
Porsche is another example of using blockchain tech from a company called Circularize. They work together to create a digital thread to map materials through their 20-tier supply chain network. The blockchain technology ensures suppliers maintain the ownership of their data, even as more data from other suppliers are added to this ever-growing digital thread. What's really neat is that customers can access history and environmental data about their cars via an app.
Apps. Man, that's like a whole nother conversation we can have. The power of the app and the pull on the digital side. We have this concept here at Zero 100 called the loop. We imagine supply chains as an infinite loop instead of as a line. And this balance or imbalance, this pull from the digital side and then the response from the supply side. And these apps really help to give a strong desire signal of what the market is needing. And that helps supply chains, of course, to respond. For them to be able to access information about our supply chains is really powerful. And I think it takes a lot of bravery in some cases for supply chains to release their data. Sometimes our data isn't perfect. but to allow consumers to be part of that journey and come along with us and find out where their materials have been, I think is really exciting. All made possible by a digital thread. So, Shelby, in our research, when we went and talked to supply chains doing this, we heard pretty consistent steps of what supply chains can do to start using a digital thread. Can you walk us through what those are?
So first you want to define the goal, right? So let's say your goal is to follow carbon through your supply chain operations. You then want to figure out how to verify an object. How do you really know an object is what you say it is? The third step is to trace materials throughout your process. This can be similar to the chain of custody. And lastly, you want to share your findings, right? So you want to share your information with customers and stakeholders in an easily accessible way.
I think a lot of people often focus on the third one about tracing materials through a process. I think the hardest one is number two, actually. How do we know a thing is a thing? I think blockchain has been really favored because it's so successful when tracking digital assets. But when we come to the physical world, digital tracking has a small limitation, of course, that physical items can get up and move around without the computers ever knowing. So I think this idea of how do we verify a thing is a thing, it's a real challenge for supply chains who are trying to do the right thing, trying to use reclaimed materials, then come to find out that those never actually made it back into their products. A lot of standards work is going into this space. Our friends at GS1, for example, are just doing a ton of work here. So I think the hardest one is number two, but happy to have a debate. If you have a different perspective, please let us know. We'd love to hear about your experiences with digital threads and how they're working or not in your organization. But I think this is one real way to look at carbon, yes, and also the energy flows. Where is energy coming from into our supply chains? Is it coming from a renewable source or not? Shelby, anything else that you'd love to share about digital threads?
We are all trying to figure out what digital transformation looks like. But the thing is, we've all in some way started to digitize everything we're doing, right? So if your organization has a digital process map of any kind, you're already on your way to creating a digital thread. So cheers to you.
Cheers to you, indeed. All of that hard work around master data, it's been a payoff. It's here. You're already on your way. Digital process maps is the miniature first step to digital threads. Shelby, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining me to explore how supply chains can use digital threads to check out their energy flows.
Absolutely. It's been fun. Thanks, Deborah.
All right, friends, there you have it. That's it for Radical Reinvention Episode 3. Thank you to Sandra McQuillan, Dr. Julio Friedman, and Nalin Agarwal for being our guests, and to 0100 Research Manager Shelby Newsom for helping bring some of our research on digital threads to life. You can find out more about our guests and the links referenced throughout the episode in the show notes. 0100 community members can check out the full interviews and our extended conversations online at 0100.com. See you next time.
This episode of Radical Reinvention was produced by Deborah Dahl, Nick Heineman, Diane Hope, and me, Victoria Marin. Shelby Newsom contributed research insights for the episode and was mixed and mastered by Ko Takasugi Chernovan, who also composed our theme music. To find out more about 0100 and to check out our content library, go to 0100.com. If you're interested in joining our community of contributors, send us a note at hello@0100.com.